But it's not even a week ago that we launched our foray into mining, back into mining, because, sure, if you go back a couple of decades, I started an organization called MineWeb, which then became a very big international business. Unfortunately, it closed down, I guess, a victim of the cycles that one sees in mining and perhaps a different view from the publisher. But here at BizNews, miningweb.com is ours, and so is the best commentator on the planet who will be giving us his insights every week on the Mining Web Weekly. His name's Peter Major. Okay, Pete, well, that's obviously underselling you big time, but...
No, you and I are going to... We're going to get hit hard for that comment, Alec, both of us.
But let's launch straight into it. There was a time in South Africa where Anglo-American was the colossus of South African business. It's anything but now. It's a global company, really, not with a heck of a lot going on in South Africa, but still one that is worth commenting on. It's going through a process that we thought interesting enough at BizNews that we added it to the BizNews portfolio. Hasn't done a heck of a lot, so it's kind of washing its face. But there are a lot of South Africans who own Anglo-American shares hoping that it is going to be successful in its change that it's going through. And the results that came out recently, I guess, would have given us an indication on that. High level, though, Anglos. Are you an investor?
I am an investor here, and I hope I'm not doing it just for historical, emotional reasons. I love the company so much. 45 years ago, I couldn't get on a plane quick enough to come work in South Africa. Funny enough, they didn't love me as much as I loved them, and I ended up at Harmony Gold Mine, which I look back on was really the right mix. It was really bitter for me at that time to be at Harmony. And Anglos did offer me a job almost 2 years after I was on Harmony. I turned it down. They offered me one 2 years later. And I almost took it. And I'm not quite sure why. I think it was PA to the head of the gold division. I didn't deserve it. And they got better people for it. But I didn't pursue it. I was actually, by then, I was aware enough of what Anglo was and the requirements. And I was kind of keener on something else that I took at the time. But Alec, Anglos is a great story that all people should know a little bit about because it's evolved so much. And it's a classic case of you buy a company because of the CEO, or do you buy it for the businesses it's in? Or you buy a gold company, do you buy it because it's got a great CEO or because it's got a lot of gold in it? And in Anglos, people bought it because of Ernest Oppenheimer, and they were not let down. People bought it because of Harry Oppenheimer. And if ever there was a father-son combination that just propelled the company even further, this company beat the all-share index for 90 years. Now, that is saying something. And the all-share index beat the S&P for 90 years by almost 2%, 1.5%. So it's incredible what it did. I like Duncan Wanblad. I think he's a great appointment. I think he's the best person to be running Anglos now. But he's under pressure that Ernest and Harry weren't. People never queried, are they the right person for the job? They could do what they wanted, and people didn't query it. Duncan is now a different time frame, and you got to say, is he doing things because the investors are demanding it, because the corporate financiers are demanding it, or the analysts are demanding it? And I saw Anglos come under that pressure in the late 90s, and they would admit to us as fund managers, oh, we're doing this because this is what you guys want us to do. Or you guys, you know, he's done it. He's done what investors want, and he's narrowed down. They produce copper. They produce iron ore. They're holding De Beers, and they're trying to get rid of it. They're trying to get rid of coal. And why is that? Did Anglos want to get rid of those things? Or is it these pseudo investors that come and go? But yeah, I own some. great assets. Anglos has always had great assets. They have very seldom have had bad management. I think Duncan is as good as they're going to get out there, and I'm happy with him. But timing is a lot, as we know, in mining shares. And you can't try and please everybody, especially when there are a lot of young propeller heads and test tube babies that just graduated. They've got a degree, and now they think they can tell a mining house how it should be doing everything.
Jeepers, it's such an interesting point you make there, because if you look at Thungela, the coal division in South Africa, the timing of that sale has to go down in history as probably almost as bad as the sale by the Anglo-Vaal operation of their business in DRC. If you recall, that was right at the bottom of the market. In fact, what they sold to Patrice Motsepe as well. But sticking with Anglo.
Yeah. Look how timing they have given up an asset they'd put billions into for decades. And look how the timing benefited Patrice when he got it. And look when Patrice got out of copper in Zambia. You know, all that money that Anglo-Vaal had put into Zambia for copper, and then all the money that African Rainbow Minerals put into it, and then Patrice gets out of it. It's a strategic decision, you know, right at the bottom of the copper price after you put in hundreds of millions of dollars, just like he got out of chrome. And who did he sell his chrome to at the bottom? Well, he sold it to his 50-50 partner, Associated Manganese. And I think nobody could predict timing, but yeah, it went. The chrome price went up right after it was sold to Asmang, and I think they paid for that whole acquisition in about a year and a half out of earnings. So got it on about a one and a half PE.
Thungela?
Same thing, Alan. Mm-hmm. You're right. Remember, Anglos was a little bit wary of letting it go for, I think, about 28. But they did it the right way. They gave it to shareholders, said, all right, you guys, you get to manage your little portfolio. Here's our coal assets, you know, just the South African coal assets. And remember this mystery U.S. hedge fund manager that said they'd calculated the value is actually zero. So even though shareholders got it at 28, some of them panicked and were selling down to 18. Or I think that's about as low as it got, you know, 18 when it listed. But it didn't take long to go back to 30, 40, 100, 200. So we all know hedge funds will always badmouth something that they want to buy. It helps them get it cheaper. And they'll always build up something they want to dump. So always be wary when a hedge fund is giving you advice to do with the share.
Especially in mining, where you have the cycles are everything. So what's the cycle like for Anglo American right now?
I don't think it's that exciting, Alec. The copper price is about $4.50, which I think is fabulous. And copper's the best of all the base metals now. You know, cobalt's blown out. Nickel's really blown out. Lead and zinc are as close to being dead. I think they're selling at the same price for the last 20 years. Lead just doesn't budge. You know, it just doesn't register. If you put a heartbeat monitor on it, it's zero. It's not bombed out, but it's not going anywhere. It's just dead here at 90 cents a pound. Zinc, 130. So copper is the best of the base metals by far. And it's everybody's darling. And you see, people pay a fortune, get into it. Everybody's making good money in copper here. I don't think anybody's production costs are over $3. If they are, get out of that share and get one that's got production costs of $2.50, because I think copper could come off. So, how's that going to benefit up Anglos? And the other big commodity they got is iron ore. Okay, iron is back over $100, which is good because we were getting scared. You know, it hadn't been below 100 for a long time. And then just about a month ago, it got down there at 95. Everybody's making a ton of money at $100. I don't think many people's production costs are over 50, 60. And so I don't see iron ore going higher. So if iron ore is not going to go higher than it is today, and if copper is not going to go higher than it is today, well, what's De Beers got left? As we know, they got some coal assets left that Peabody hasn't taken, and they've got De Beers. And boy, who thinks diamond demand is going to pick up in the next year? So it looks cheap. It is cheap. They're going to make money off what they've got, but it's probably not going to go up unless iron ore or copper go up higher, that I can't see them doing it at this time. I don't think Angles will go up too much more.
Pete, the Peabody not wanting to take the coal assets, what do we make of that?
This, to me, this is like a replay of when Sibania bought that asset from Appian Asset Managers a few years ago. And I thought Sibania was running out on a crazy shopping spree. And I don't know if it's because they had this French corporate financier that was going to show them how you spend money that you made that you never planned on making. Because remember, after they bought Sibania Stillwater in Montana, we thought, oh man, this is going to end it. You know, their debt is so high, they're going to pop. COVID hit, PGM prices took off, and all our platinum companies went from tens of billions of rands debt to tens of billions of rands on the balance sheet. Positive. They paid off all their debt, had cash. So Sibania bought this asset, this mine from Appian, and I think they had buyer's remorse within weeks of buying it. They paid a high price for it, I thought. I got yelled at for saying that. Within a month or two, literally, it seemed so soon after they bought it, the mine had a landslide, and immediately, I don't think the rocks had started. Had stopped rolling down the hill. I think the dust was still rising up from the pit, and we heard Sibania is backing out of the deal, you know, because it's a damaged asset. It's not what they thought they were buying. And Appian was really, really quick to say, hey, this landslide has caused a little bit of damage, but nothing that's going to affect the value of the asset more than a few single-digit percent, you know, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5%. And they pursued it. So both sides pursued this attitude. Appian says, you made a deal, competitive bidding. The asset is not that damaged. And they got good consultants, advisors, legal, mining, geology to prove their case. And Sibania tried to do the same to prove, no, it was worth them walking away. They didn't want the assets. And boy, we saw what happened in the court case a few years later. The court ruled in Appian's favor. And now Sibania has been negotiating, and they're going to, I think it's over $600 million it looks like they're going to have to pay, which is probably almost two-thirds of the value of had they just bought the assets. I think there's a good chance Anglos can be the Appian here. Anglos just needs to prove that the fire has not done that much damage to that coal mine, and that it was a fair competitive bidding process and Peabody won it, and they can't just back out for any little reason. And why are they backing out? Why would they want to back out? I don't know enough details, Allie, but the coal price is not what it was when this bidding process was going on. Coal has also dipped below 100 and it's not back over 100 yet. And most coal producers can make money here at $95 for steam coal grade number one. But, hey, we were starting to get used to $130 coal price, $140. Nobody should have been getting used to $200 coal price. That was nonsense. But, yeah, so we see coal here at $95. Maybe it's going to get back to $100. But if it does, I don't think it's going to go back over $100. So my guess off the top of my head, and I'll be shot for this, is the market. The environment changed from when Peabody made that competitive bid. And this is a very good excuse to try and use to get out of it. And yeah, I think this thing's going to go to court because there's probably not going to be the rush of buyers for that asset that Anglos had when they originally put it up for sale two years ago.
Anglos advisors are going to get rich. And if we have a repeat of what happened in the Sibania case, Peabody's management might be making a big mistake. But talking about Sibania, the results, the latest results are coming out. Is this going to be Neil Froneman's swan song? Is it?
I think so. And I think he'll be lucky to get out with these results. He had a godsend in PGM prices here. They've really shot up literally in just the last few months. You know, I think platinum is up almost 50%. In barely 2 months, rhodium up nearly 50% in 2 months, you know, palladium up 30. So that's the big three components they make. But they get ruthenium, they get iridium. They've all gone up, but those are the three big ones that have really risen. And it is crazy. I watch these prices. Platinum has been averaging $1,000 an ounce, Alec, for 10 years. It's almost like the lead price, okay? It'll go up to $1,100. It won't stay there. It'll go down to $859. It won't stay. But most of the time, platinum has been flatlining for 10 years at $1,000 an ounce. Now it goes up to $1,450, you know, and literally in 6, 7, 8 weeks, you know, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And rhodium paralleling it. And palladium was lagging, but they all jumped up. And Sibania's geared. But we got to remember, these PGM prices have risen off a fairly low base. They had really tumbled. I think the average, we calculate the average revenue for a ton of PGM ore in our industry, it hit a high of $450 a ton. And that was Looney Tunes. And it started falling from 450 to 4, 353, 252. Well, last year this time, it was averaging 150. So can you imagine your revenue falls two-thirds? And I guarantee your costs haven't fallen two-thirds. They probably haven't fallen 5%. So they were under pressure the last 12 months, big pressure, you know, average basket price, $150 a ton. Now these prices have jumped to 220. So that's a nice jump. That's over 30%. So Neil, he's lucky to get out with these prices here, because as Paul Dunn says at Northam, this was too much too quick and we don't trust it. We think it's going to slip.
That's an interesting point there, when you start talking about prices, because we had DRD Gold's results out today, and its average gold price is up 36%. So nice numbers, 60% higher on the operating costs, operating profits rather. But you've got all of those South African gold miners reporting in the next week. DRD showing the way. Is it something that we can expect also to come from? I think it's later this week. We're going to see Gold Fields and then Harmony. Similar type of numbers, or was DRD an exception?
No, we're going to see it all across the board. Pan African, Harmony, all they can do, they're all enjoying it. So I won't say all they can do. What they need to be doing is watch those costs, because costs explode just like the commodity price. And you get hit from all ends. All of a sudden, your suppliers come up with these 20, 30% cost increases, and you really need them. You don't have time to go look for another supplier. So you start accepting increases you know are too high that you don't want to. And hey, it's been real quiet on the labor front, because they did good by signing for 3, 4, 5 year terms. That means that can't just rise up. I won't say brilliant, but those were great agreements. And they were great agreements for both sides, because if the workers know they're going to get a 6-7% increase, they're guaranteed a job, they can get a bank loan, the bank's happy because they know they're working for a real company that's going to be around. It's good for everybody. But if gold stays here, the costs are still going to be coming up, but they're still on very good margins. Probably the biggest risk these companies have is, how do you allocate your capital? And I think Durban Deep has probably allocated its capital more conservatively, more wisely than any of the other gold companies. And I'm not bad-mouthing them as much as I'm bragging up Durban Deep. They have to allocate it correctly, because they are on the world's most marginal ore body. It doesn't change. It can't change. You know, billions of tons of very, very low grade. So if the gold price goes down, there's almost nothing they can do. So they are really reinvesting that money, planning for the worst, you know, planning that gold could come down, and continually improving their processes of extraction, processes that help them utilize the asset they've got. Because all the other mines can go out and find other ore bodies. Although I say find, they can do that, but they don't as much as go out and buy other ore bodies. And nobody beats the index by buying ore bodies. They're already in production or staked out by somebody else. People need to remember Anglo-American beat the index, not because they had desk jockeys sitting at their screen doing corporate deals left and right, trying to beat the other guy. That's how you underperform the index by trading. You beat the index by putting money in your own company and finding assets or processes that nobody's found before, and you nurture them from zero to stage one, stage two, and then you only release them to go flying into the market when you've extracted 70% or more of the value. And that's what the Oppenheimers did. That's what our gold shares need to do. Durbin Deep, it's kind of what Neil's doing. You don't see him buying other operating assets. You see him buying assets that people don't even know exist, or that they're too difficult. And it's long term, you know, negotiating these dumps, the land, the people around it, and then working out how many pipes do I have to put in, how far do I pump it, you know, what's my average recovery going to be. But you got to be impressed. When the company's had the same CEO for this long, he knows it so well, all aspects of the business. He's a very astute person. He knows his business. Ergo was great. That was created by Anglos. But I've been so impressed. The level of technical expertise at DRD has exceeded what Anglos had at Ergo decades ago. You know, he's picked up from that and carried it. But boy, that is the world's most marginal gold mine. So if the gold price comes down, don't blame Neil. He's done as good a job of controlling costs and cost-saving innovations, but this is a pure gold price-related investment.
So Neil Pretorius has done extraordinarily well, and he's still looking around and scratching for other assets that DRD can turn to account. But what about South Africa as a whole? On the BizNews Mining Web WhatsApp channel, it's for our premium subscribers, there's been a lot of debate about exploration in South Africa, and they were asking me to pose that to you. Exploration in South Africa is kind of nowhere. I don't know if it's fallen off the bus completely or if it's about to fall off the last little bit off the bus. But what, in your perception, is the problem here, and what could turn it around?
Gee, we know the problem. It's got three letters, huh? It starts with A and it ends with C. And that is the biggest problem with exploration in this country. It's no secret. Everybody knows it. First of all,
so for those who don't know, we're talking ANC, the socialist ruling party in South Africa.
Yeah, if it was only socialist, if it wasn't kleptomania. Anyways, the kleptocracy. So let's look at exploration. You're out in your backyard, you're out on the mountain, you're exploring. And whether you plan on finding something or you accidentally find on something, you come up with a shiny rock and you get it tested, you talk to experts, and that's a valuable rock, whether it's gold, platinum, copper, doesn't matter. It costs money to do professional exploration, to find a deposit large enough to be economically viable. And we know small mines are not economically viable because they have to do so much of the same things the big mines have, but they don't have the resources, the expertise, especially nowadays. You know, ESG, community relations, health, safety, the list goes on. It costs as much for a little company to do that. The admin work, you know, the running around chasing, where's my permit? When's it going to get processed? So people don't want to explore in South Africa because even if they find something, they can't raise money to take it up the curve. They can't find somebody to sell it to. And the big companies aren't exploring here because they say, we've got 5 years left, we got 10 years left, but if the trend is your friend, we are in a horrible trend. We're in a trend where the infrastructure is getting worse and worse, where the uncertainty of legislation is getting worse, and the certainty of the legislation is bad. You know, Gwede always says, okay, I've removed uncertainty. You know, we're just going to take 51% of every diamond project. Well, you might have certainty in it, but that's not bringing in money. You know, the ANC to say, diamonds are special. You have to give up 51%. Well, they changed that after a decade or so. But it just shows their policy is not well thought out. It's thought out by people that don't know what they're doing. So let's get back. That's why people are not investing in exploration. Because South Africa probably has more known minerals than any single country in the world. But yes, what you know, you sink a shaft, you build a mine, you know there's so much there, but you have to continually drill, use geophysics, explore, put people on the ground, but there's no return in that investment. So I think that simplifies your question. There's no return in investment because even if you find something, you can't find somebody to develop it with you. You can't find anybody to buy it. And it's because of the whole perception, which is a true perception, that South Africa is not an easy, stable, good place to do business with, especially in mining. There's too many kleptocrats all around mining who misjudged it by a mile, who thought a gold mine is just a hole in the ground that sends out gold bricks, like a gusher of an oil well in Texas in the old days. And they don't realize, no, a mine is a black hole. It's an enormous, giant black shaft that sucks more money than you'll ever see, that you'll ever put together. And only if it's finely balanced and managed by like a symphony conductor that Oppenheimer's and our other mining giants were, they have to manage all these different moving plates on the sticks correctly. Then it will produce money for the good of the country. But yeah, our legislation and their attitude. They don't even show an attitude that says we do want investment, we do understand. So I'm in the exploration business, raising money. I've got lots of clients with good projects, good properties. And it's one step above impossible to find anybody anywhere, locally or overseas, that will put money in. Not that they doubt the minerals, not that they doubt the integrity of the people who've explored or want to. They just say, what will I do with it if I get it?
Peter, that's really worrying because speaking to James from the DA, Lorimer, James Lorimer, who's their spokesperson on mining, he has articulated very well the results of exploration off the South African coast for oil and gas and how Namibia is now the next big oil and gas province in the world, but South Africa's got a multiple of the Namibian resources, but no one's drilling because of this.
Boy, we talk mining long term. We talk mining exploration expensive. Oil and gas industry is a quantum above that. We are so far behind on that. Yeah, Namibia may be on the verge of realizing 20 to 25 years, if they've been very favorably promoting their potential for oil and gas. And there's been a lot of money put into it during that because they've always kept the same story. And it's been a very positive story, literally up until very, very recently. But we did the opposite. The ANC, and we can say Gwede Mantashe and our other mining ministers, they want to stop the cavalry right at the start, you know, head them off at the pass. So remember when we had this oil shale boom, and there were figures going around, I don't know where they came from. You know, South Africa could have the third largest resources, reserves of oil shale, if that wasn't poppycock, even when it came out. The ANC seemed to fall for it because they immediately put a freeze on any kind of exploration for shale gas. They said, oh, this is a special, special resource. We got to really study how we're going to maximize this for the good of the country. So I think they put a freeze on that exploration. And then while it was frozen, they were babbling about how big a chunk the state is going to take. What kind of BE they're going to specially design for this and all the other rules and regulations. And they kept that up. You know, they didn't just say it for a week or a month. They kept it up for years. And I kept yelling at the same time, guys, we don't have a clue what we've got. Exploration would tell us that. You know, why not open it for everybody for exploration with no rules. Let them go out there, drill the pee out of it, and then you can make it difficult, if you still desire, for them to get the processing license, the producing license. But at least get the people out there prospecting. They will tell us what we've got. So here we are 20 years later. We don't have a clue what we've got. Maybe it doesn't matter. We couldn't get it out anyways. But we're always so afraid that some company might make a couple bucks return on investment for its shareholders taking the big risk. We're so afraid of that that we rush out as soon as there's a chance some new product, some mineral, some oil, some gas might have a great demand. We're continually shooting any little ray of hope that may appear, you know, any crack of sunlight that starts coming through that we got a chance of benefiting by financially for the country, we run and we board it up. And so, yeah, Namibia is right next door. Take a look at their gold exploration. Take a look at their gold production, what they've done the last 20 years. Boy, there are big companies mining big mines in Namibia. And yeah, they're making big money. And I'll tell you where most of that money's going, Alec, is right back into the ground. Those companies are recycling much, much more of it than they're paying out in dividends. And that's always been the case. So it's total fallacy that the mines come and they send all the profits out. Even if you had 80% shareholders and you're sending 80% of the profits, if you're only declaring a dividend that's 20% of your earnings, you're putting 80% of the earnings back in the country, who cares if you're sending 100% of the profits out? If it's 100% of the shareholders are outside the country, it's their money they're risking. Their money's still tied up in the country. It's not even child thinking.
And it is also supported by Professor William Gumede's recent research, where he says that 100 people have got a trillion rand from BEE. And it's almost like it's our turn. You can't make any money unless we make the money first. So South Africa's people are being very, very poorly served in this respect as well. But maybe a big question here. We've seen the world chase after rare earths. The Chinese have most of them. You'd think South Africa, with its treasure chest of minerals, might have some rare earths as well that could be exploitable.
We definitely have rare earths that are exploitable. Your default in this mining business, Alec, is if some commodity all of a sudden has a big demand for it, you can bet your bottom dollar, 90-95% chance, South Africa has that commodity. The only one we haven't found is silver. We have very little silver in this country. And I'll bet if the silver price goes up to $50, we'll find out we have a lot more. But yes, do we have a lot of rare earths? I don't know. I think there's a 50-50 chance we have a lot of rare earths. Do we have rare earths that are exploitable, that are economic? Definitely. And they are well known. The two most well known are Rainbow Minerals rare earths up there on the Palabora tailings dams, because we know there's lots of rare earths as a byproduct of phosphate mining, and there's a lot of rare earths available from heavy mineral sands mining, and we have pure rare earth deposits, virgin greenfields rare earth deposits. Well, the richest one on the planet, probably the most well-known rare earth, is Steenkamp's Kraal, 3 hours, 3.5 hours out of Cape Town, that was run for on behalf of the British in the late 50s, and they contracted a well-known mining company to do the mining for them named Anglo American. And it's amazing. You go out to Steenkamp's Kraal, it is really out in the desert. And we know deserts are very dry, very little rust, very little erosion from water. And Steenkamp's Kraal, up until a few years ago, it looked just like it did 50 years ago. 50, 60 years. Very, very high grade. And high grade rare earth means radioactive. And the company that did a lot of work on it, that was selling it, they've worked out all the details. They got some money from a Canadian firm about 10 years ago when we had a real rare earth boom, even more than 10 years, about 12 years ago. They've done all the studies. It's so rich in rare earth that the people that work there a week have to take a week off. then they get another week on, week off, just to make sure they don't get bad doses. And this thing has been marketed for decades by the same individual, but he was always asking a little too much, people thought. And he sold it twice, got money in for it. Then when the rare earth price went down, he managed to buy it back both times. Now, unfortunately, Trevor has passed away, and there's a little bit of a consortium. His heirs have it, but they've not managed to do a deal with the real miner. They've not managed to do a deal with the foreigner. And as you say, the Chinese, this is their game. You know, China is like, China and rare earths are like South Africa used to be with gold and diamonds, huh? 70% of gold at one time, 70, 75% of world gold production came from here. Well, China, they haven't tied up all the rare earth mining, but they have virtually tied up 85, 90% of refining. And boy, they've taken it to a high, high level that nobody can afford to build a refinery now. For what you can send your rare earths to China, they refine it, you get it back. It's just like China's done with smelting of most metals, especially base metals. Nobody can build a smelter to compete or a refinery to compete with their low cost. So why hasn't China come in here? One of the reasons is that we've been told for the last 10 years, one of the reasons foreigners haven't bought Steenkamp's Kraal is because there's this threat the state will not let them, that the state considers rare earths strategic for South Africa's future, and that anybody buying it has to get permission from the government. And whether they have to use the IDC or there's going to be another government vehicle created. And so if we didn't have enough negatives putting people off investing in South Africa, there's this one hanging over Steenkamp's Kraal. Look, we have another deposit north of Steenkamp's Kraal, about another hour and a half. It's controlled by a Canadian company. It's got some Korean investors. But again, that deposit is well drilled out. They know the size, the shape, the grade. They know the type of rare earths because there's over 15 of them. They know which ones are going to come out the most. Yeah, I hate blaming everything on the ANC, hate blaming everything on the government, but they could do more to clarify, do they really want foreign investment? Would they like to develop our rare earths? Or do they say, you got to come to us and talk nice to us because we might just give this to Donald Trump? Well, they don't have it, okay? The state does control the minerals, so in a way they do have it. They've given out 20, 25-year mining licenses, so you can say, well, I have it. But Gwede reminds us, if you don't do what we like, we can pull back your mining license. So you only kind of have it. You know, you have it at our pleasure. So it's this constant barrage of those kind of reminders, who really has our minerals, and can they be clutched back by the government, even though you've got a mining license? And I remind investors, the government has not taken away a mining license from anybody that I know of in 25 years for more than a couple of weeks. And I think they've only taken a mining license away from one company I know. And funny enough, it was a BE company and it was a coal miner. And they never should have got the license in the first place. They should have had it taken away a long time before they did. And they got it back within weeks. So again, Gwede, their actions aren't quite as bad as their words, but why have bad words or bad actions? You know, why not say nice things and do nice things and get investment on these? So we have rare earths. They're just not being developed.
Interesting point you make there about Donald Trump as well. Maybe that is a Trump card that the South African trade negotiators are trying to use. Just to close off with, talking about things we do have here, high quality manganese is in great demand now, given the batteries and how important they're going to be for electric cars and so on. And our mutual friend, Bernard Swanepoel, has got a fabulous business in Mpumalanga, MMC. How are they doing? Do you have any insight on that? Because if they're able to cash in on this boom, well, then surely others might be looking for similar things in South Africa. What you've just told us about the licensing regime and the exploration maybe that's, it doesn't matter how good you are, maybe that's going to be a big deterrent.
Alec, I've forgotten most of what I knew about Burners MMC, and I'm behind the curve on what's been happening there the last 12 months. But I used to follow it up until about a year or so ago, fairly reasonably. And I think Bernard was actually going out of his way to keep it a secret because the margins were very good. And we know, especially in this country, if you're doing well at something, you don't really want to advertise it. In a normal country, you would, because by advertising how good you're doing, you could get investment. But we know whatever the investment is here, no matter how good it looks, foreigners don't want to come and invest here for a multitude of reasons, and almost all of them are genuine. So Bernard's company was doing great out there. They took it over. I think it was AngloVol that had it originally. I hope it wasn't Asmang. I'm going to be shot for this. I'm really rusty. But it had good management. It had a good niche market. And yes, it was upgrading our manganese multiples from just sending out the raw ore that the rest of the world wants. And it was all about expanding the market. But even more, if we could take it up this value curve, it goes exponential, like a lot of our minerals. From selling it in its raw form to moderately processed. And boy, the whole world's going to such high tech. They need real pure minerals. And they pay for that. And we were talking earlier about if you got a good quartz deposit, silica, you know, silica's amazing. You can get literally hundreds of times the price that you can for normal silica sand if it's so pure and so refined. So it was a couple junior Indabas ago, Bernard had his team present MMC's MD, and I think the technical director there, maybe his financial director, they were presenting to the audience how this operation really works and how it's adding value, but how it could really, it could get 10 times the value out of the same amount of product, but they've got to put a lot of capex in. You know, you have to invest in a lot of high-tech processes and equipment that goes with it. But they've done the studies. They had the quotes. And I don't know if they did get the funding to do that or if they decided, let's see if South Africa settles down a little bit. Because every year seems so tumultuous that you say it's really prudent to wait one more year before we do this. And it's big money. You know, taking things up the curve, it's exponential money. Like we say, removing the smoke from a smokestack at a coal-fired power plant. You know, you can just put in a dust filter, a baghouse, or you can put in water nozzles, or you can put in electrostatic precipitators, and you can get 90% of that pretty economically. But boy, when you go for that other 10%, the quantum of expense and technology, it goes up exponentially. I don't know where they are with that now, but the margins were very, very good. Long established production. I think they've been going for over 40 years, but I don't know if they ever got the capex to take it higher up the curve or if they've just kept it at the same level it's been for quite a while now. It's worth following on that because that shows what we can do, but did we ever have any doubt in this country what we could do? You know, what Anglo's and AngloVol, you know, what they were all doing here in the 50s and 60s, making oil from coal in the 50s and early 60s, you know, Sasol, genius operation. And Graham Bostrad at Anglo's doing Highfeld vanadium and steel, you know, taking this iron ore that Anglo's had discovered, but it was infused with vanadium, trying to separate that, and it still had titanium in it, and he made Highfeld into a great industry. So we can do those processes, but you need government to do its role, and it's not done its role. It's gone out of its way to do the opposite. So it's got to have a change in government before people can add beneficiation to almost anything from current levels. A big change in government attitude and action.
Peter, Peter Major from, well, he's the mining director at Modern Corporate Solutions, reminding us that the bedrock of the South African economy has been mining for decades and decades. But we've just, like in many other areas, been shooting ourselves in both feet. Maybe now that South Africans are starting to join the dots on other areas, they'll start joining the dots on mining as well, which could turbocharge an economy that has not grown faster than the population growth for more than 15 years. We'll be back with the Mining Web Weekly, same time, same place next week. Until then, I'm Alec Hogg, editor of BizNews.